This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's unusual for reporters to get personally involved in the stories they cover, but reporter Carrie Lester signed a letter calling out sexual harassment in Springfield.
It occurred to me that I should put my money where my mouth is. Some of the things I have experienced and some of the things that I have watched other colleagues experience really hammered home to me that the culture needs to change down there.
Over the weekend, the Legislative Ethics Commission appointed a new Legislative Inspector General, a position that has been vacant. We'll have the story. A wave of pet illnesses is working through the Twin Cities. During an edition of Animal House, find out how you can prevent parvovirus. And Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos stops by to talk about a probable property tax increase. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's November 7th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Bloomington aldermen discussed city and library taxes and management of the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts. Aldermen agreed to a slight increase for the library levy, but despite looming structural deficit, held the line on taxes, which helped balance the city's budget previously. In the studio is Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. The community's mayors join us on Sound Ideas most Tuesdays following Monday evening council meetings. Terry, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Great to be here.
How do property taxes levied by the city compare with other nearby communities? Was there movement or room to move those property taxes up to help address what is a looming structural deficit in the community?
Oh, absolutely. We have not really effectively raised the city of Bloomington's share of property taxes in about 8-9 years. Now, my property taxes have gone up. You know, anybody who lives in Bloomington knows that. It's not because of the city's portion. Actually, the city's portion has gone down by several hundred dollars for the average person. We have made a decision as a council to keep the hold the line on property taxes because we know the school districts depend exclusively on that, as does the library. And so we're leaving that to the other taxing authorities. We're going to hold the line this year. On our budget, we may explore some fees. We might even re-explore. I think we should re-explore video poker machines, which cost nothing. Yet $1 million is taken out of our economy every week because of that. I think there are many other things that we can explore other than property taxes, which are, I think, very unfair and very regressive.
So you still are, though, taking one tool out of the toolbox to address the $3 million
Absolutely. And I'm okay taking that tool out because I was not planning on using that tool. And I don't think the council was.
So the effect that the actual effect on the vote last night on the levy is meaningless to the average property taxpayer, right?
Their taxes are not going to go up. They're not going to go up. And then the $4 for the library is not for a year is not really something that many people are going to really even notice. Now, the school systems may need to do that. The thing they also need to keep in mind and is that who knows what the state could do. The state could freeze property taxes, mm-hmm. which means your costs may go up and you may have real problems, especially our schools.
So we're back to golf courses and solid waste. What happened to the solid waste task force you appointed? There was a task force to look at solid waste and try to address that.
They were supposed to come back with a solution. This is 3 years ago, I believe. Two and a half years ago.
Yeah.
It collapsed after a couple weeks because the city council is composed of 9 people from 9 wards, and all of them wanted to have something different. And we thought we had an agreement. I mean, this was years before I even became mayor. And it lasted another 2 years. You'd think if you have an enterprise fund, you either cut the service or you charge more for the service. There's only one of two ways to balance a budget. And unfortunately, we keep running deficits. And I'm hopeful that I'm always hopeful that the council will come forward and try to close that gap. But that was an absolute unmitigated failure. So, obviously, we've never come back with a solution on trash.
Well, let me continue with the word failure. I mean, you're right back. The city is right back where it was 3 years ago.
mm-hmm. right? I mean, what's happened in the past 3 years to address the budget issues that we knew would be facing, that the city would be facing today?
You're talking about with solid waste?
Solid waste, everything.
I mean, we've done lots of things on other than solid waste. Absolutely. The budget.
You're back to talking about a golf course again, right?
No, this is Alderman Sage talking about golf courses that are in his ward, and that's just silly. We have information that the staff provided quite clearly that even privatizing the golf courses is not going to save us any money.
So what has the city and what has council done in terms of addressing the structural deficit?
Absolutely.
We have
followed everything that the budget task force tried to do. We have tried to search down anything we could, and some of them were fruitful. Most, they're minor things, but most of the big ticket items weren't. It turned out selling our golf courses, privatizing our golf courses is not going to help because we're still on the line for capital expenditures.
So
it turns out that there are any number of things that the budget task force asked us to take a look at that showed us there is no pot of gold. We went from having 850 full-time equivalent employees 9 years ago to 750 today, and we have more people. So we're delivering the same services to more people with fewer employees. And so that doesn't mean we can't make some cuts. It's just much more difficult, and we got to be very careful and surgical about making those cuts. So I say the budget task force was a success. Any solid waste subcommittee that was supposed to go get together, and that was highly informal, they never came back because you couldn't get five votes on the city council to agree on anything having to do with trash.
Well, the budget task force, though, weren't they saved by one of the recommendations, which was basically to look at revenue increases, and the city adopted or accepted the sales tax increase.
Right.
That helped, right?
Right. Well, and that was also that we did have a penny sales tax increase. A quarter penny goes to the county for mental health. A quarter penny goes directly to streets and infrastructure. It's earmarked. And a half penny goes to the operations of the city. And that's one of the things that we found is that, okay, we have funded our pensions and we have gotten an award for funding our police fire pensions. We don't need fewer cops. We don't need fewer firefighters. Nobody seems to want to give up at anything on solid waste or brush pickup or bulk waste pickup.
So where are the big cuts going to come to find the $3 million, and will the council have the stomach to make those cuts?
I don't know where else they're going to come from other than Parks and Rec. Unless you abandon all of Parks and Rec, which we can't do and we're not going to do, is there are no things. We've got to explore other ways of trying to be more efficient. We might very well find some things that are small that we could privatize. There may be some other small ways. We're constantly looking at ways for
debts. It has to total $3 million, though.
We're going to get there.
Okay. Before we talk about the Bloomington Public Library and the property tax increase to support the library, I have to state, as Connect Transit's board chair, I've spoken in favor of the Tier 1 Catalyst project that is in the Bloomington Task Force report for a joint library, Connect Transit, Transfer Center, and parking garage at the current Market Street parking garage
location. I'm glad you said that because I want to tell you, I'm not chair of the Connect Transit Board, but I have done exactly the same thing.
Okay.
I have spoken publicly in favor of that. I think it is a very good idea for us to at least explore the possibilities. And that's what the task force was designed to do. And its main goal, its main governing documents were our downtown plan and our comprehensive plan that thousands and thousands of people were involved in producing. There was one vote that was not a formal vote. It was just an informal straw poll back in June as to whether or not the city council thought it was a good idea to keep it at its current location. And I was actually one of those who said I thought it would be better to keep it at its current location. But there is this thing called evidence and facts. And we may be in the Trump era, but facts and evidence matter. And that's why I don't know that I'm totally there yet, but I'm about 80% there.
So the Bloomington Public Library will get a bump, a levy bump, more revenue from property taxes. Not much. Why was this increase okay?
I think this was essential. We are still lower than every other metro, lower than normal, lower than Decatur, lower than Springfield, in terms of the amount of that is levied for our library. And no matter what, the library needs capital expenditures. The council may very well decide they don't want the project downtown. Okay. If they want to continue and expand on the current site, okay. Or, at the very least, They're going to need to fix up the current facility. So no matter what, they need money for capital expenditures. So there are really three items. I'm guessing the two most likely would be expanding on its current location or moving to the Market Street Garage and partnering with Connect Transit. But if those things don't happen, they're still going to need capital expenditures.
So in your mind, is this levy increase tied to where the library may be located in the future or whether expansion happens?
It's not tied at all. And I don't quite understand why there was confusion about this last night. It is not tied at all. No matter what happens, the library is going to need capital expenditures to make capital improvements. There are no free lunches, and they need that money.
Here's how Alderman Jamie Mathey put it last night, his view of how the increased revenue could be used.
I mean, my personal preference would be I would like to get a better idea of what, when, and where, and how this is all going to work. So to me, this would be a good spend of those dollars trying to figure that part out of what this all looks like. I know there's still some other outstanding questions, but I think that's an important piece of all this going forward before we launch into any kind of a bigger capital campaign. We need more of a solid idea of what you guys are thinking about. So I think I would support this completely. So,
Ward 1 Alderman Jamie Mathey from last night's council meeting. What do you think? Can some of this money be used for planning purposes?
It certainly can. It is for capital improvements, long-term change. There has been some money spent on investing and looking at the current location. That happens all the time. And it doesn't mean that you're tied to that. It could be that there are other options. There are some times where many cities have explored, not just for libraries, two or three or four sites, and then they decide on one. And that's what I think is one of the reasons why I have strongly encouraged the city council to go to the National League of Cities, to go to the Ohlone Municipal League, talk to people in other communities and other places, so you have a comparative perspective on economic development, on building of libraries, or whatever it might be. Frankly, I would say if you do not have, and I'm dating myself, if you don't have the equivalent of a Rolodex of at least 10 pals who are in your position in other places that you can pick up the phone and talk to immediately, you're not doing your job. And that's desperately needed in all communities, and especially in Bloomington.
That's Mayor Terry Renner in the studio for Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Why not consolidate management of the BCPA and the arena with one management organization? Why not Venue Works for the BCPA?
Well, there were several issues involved in this. One was the track record of Venue Works, and they, let's put it this way, they inherited a mess. Let's start with that. And I said that to Lynn Cannon last night. We know you inherited a mess. But in the year and a half or so that you've been involved, you have made some improvements, certainly some improvements in transparency. We're very appreciative of that. But it's not like there's been a home run or even a triple hit in terms of bookings. And we do realize that there is a time that is necessary to get up to speed. But we are not there yet. The other thing is, and I think former Mayor Jesse Smart brought this up very well in his public comments, and that is there are 200 to 300 people who volunteer for the BCPA, and they do it because it is a public good, not because they want to try to improve the profits of a particular organization.
So if you think Venue Works had more time to prove itself, more time to turn around the arena, they might have gotten that contract to manage the BCPA?
I think it would have been a much, much closer call. Yes.
Jim Waldorf with the Friends of the BCPA spoke last night and expressed some frustration. Let's listen to what he had to say, and then I'll ask you about it.
I don't understand why we've had all of the delays with getting an executive director rehired, getting a grant writer rehired, getting the open positions at the BCPA rehired, because we're getting constant discussion about the deficit, but the very people, the very positions that would help us eliminate that deficit or control that deficit and be successful have been left empty.
Now that the city has committed to managing the BCPA, what about those positions Jim Waldorf speaks of?
Those are positions that need to be filled. And I realize this is an administrative question. It is an administrative question I had many conversations with the previous city manager about. I think that there are people at the BCPA who felt that they had been stifled. And there is also the argument that, hey, if you might privatize this, then why hire some new people?
So that was the delay, you think?
That was
the
I think for the that delay? That was the delay. And
or
I think
Jim
that was
Waldorf put it a tap on the brakes. You know, the brakes were being tapped, even though the...
I think the brakes were easily being tapped, if not maybe a more strong metaphor.
So what or who was responsible for the delay in hiring what sounds like critical positions for the BCPA? Well, for former city manager Ailes?
Ultimately, I mean, obviously Jay Tetzloff is the head of Parks and Rec, but he also reports to former city manager Ailes. And this is definitely one of those areas that... we've had multiple conversations with. I've had many conversations with Mr. Ailes about this very issue.
So the council has made its decision that the city will manage the BCPA, so full steam ahead on hiring critical positions for the Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts.
By full steam ahead, we are going to take a look at every position, and some of those positions that Jim Waldorf mentioned, I think, are essential. But we're going to be looking at every position before we approve this particular budget, because obviously we're in tough budget times. But the BCPA has had the noose around its neck, and that has been very harmful. And I think we've got to look at not just the money in the short run, but the money in the long run. And remember what former Mayor Jesse Smart said. This was never supposed to be a money-producing venue. This was supposed to be a community contribution to quality of life and to arts and culture in our community.
Okay, Terry, thanks for your time. Always more questions than we have time for.
Okay,
Mayor Terry Renner joins us most Tuesdays following Monday evening Bloomington Council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Town of Normal Mayor Chris Koos. It's Sound Ideas.
For GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, proud to serve you from his new office in historic downtown Bloomington. Justin offers life insurance options to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Unit 5's school board reluctantly voted last night to approve property tax breaks for a Canadian manufacturer that wants to bring hundreds of new jobs to McLean County. GLT's Ryan Denham was there and has this report on their hesitation, as well as an interview with the company's president about why he chose Central Illinois.
Brandt Industries wants to buy the Kongskild plant between Normal and Hudson and turn it into its first U.S. manufacturing plant. It now makes its agricultural equipment only in Canada. To do that, it's seeking around $600,000 in property tax breaks, called abatements, over the next 10 years. That means less money coming into local schools and property taxes, with the upside of new jobs and new families moving into the area. And if Brandt doesn't deliver the jobs, they don't get the money. That uncomfortable trade-off took center stage Monday as Unit 5 School Board voted 5-2 to approve the tax breaks. Board member Joe Cleary says he was compelled to vote yes because of the jobs, but wasn't happy about it.
I really don't like this deal. I don't know how many times I could say I don't like this deal, but I'm going to have to back the administration on this because I really think that if we don't at this point, we weren't privy to all this, the back and forth, you know, we're giving up an opportunity for our community.
Tanya Leffler echoed many other board members who were unhappy to only get a final version of the tax break agreement the night before the meeting. The local Economic Development Council has been working with Brandt for 5 months, including the last 2 weeks of intense negotiations. Leffler says the deal doesn't feel fully vetted. She voted no.
And I'm trying to understand from the perspective of a board member protecting our children how this is a good deal for us. I think it sounds like Brandt is a great company. I think it sounds like they would be very good for our community, but I'm not understanding why this should be on the backs of our kids.
Board member Mita Mickens-Baker also wasn't happy with the late notice. She says she was conflicted but voted yes because she's seen what happens when employers begin to vanish. Officials say Kongskild is planning to move out of the plant anyway, meaning the district would likely lose revenue over the long term regardless.
And I don't want us to decline because we have businesses that close and new ones don't come in. So as hard as it is for me to look at an agreement that might mean we will have to make some changes in how we offer things to students, we may be asking Brandt to help us in many different ways. With that, I'm going to vote yes. Because in the bottom line, I don't want our community to be one of the school districts where we decline and decline and decline and our services decline and decline because we don't have people employed bringing new revenue to our community.
Economic Development Council CEO Kyle Hamm addressed concerns about the last-minute negotiations, which included Superintendent Mark Daniel.
It literally was still being negotiated over this past weekend. We think that what we've put before you is sound. It mirrors in a lot of ways what was done with Rivian.
That's a reference to a similar tax break agreement approved in December 2016 for Rivian Automotive, which moved into the Mitsubishi Motors plant in Normal. Mickens Baker asked Hamm if they needed to decide that day. He said yes.
This decision allows them to go forward and make a lot of other decisions over the next month as they close out on that property. So any delay would be a serious challenge for them coming to this community.
Superintendent Daniels supported the agreement. He says the state's new funding formula makes it even more important for Unit 5 to grow enrollment. As he put it, if you're not growing, you're dying.
Our new funding formula is driven by enrollment. If we don't have enrollment increases, we're not going to have an increase in revenue coming to our district. So if you're in declining enrollment, and it's going to be a three-year phase-in, but if you have declining enrollment, it will impact us even more so in regards to dollars coming from state contribution.
Kyle Hamm from the EDC says Brandt has been a good community partner in other places where it's operated.
Knowing their background, what they've done in other communities, they invest. They invest in the community philanthropically, but they are committed to their base of operations and their employees. So these opportunities don't come along very often. And I know that there are other communities vying for this project. So I would really hate to see an opportunity like this slip when we are experiencing, you know, other challenges in the state of Illinois, as we all know, that we can bring quality manufacturing jobs back to our community.
Daniels says that this tax break agreement is different because the school district gets something tangible in return. Written into the agreement are in-kind rebates from Brandt, such as student mentorship and donated equipment. Daniels says that could help the district's science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics, or STEAM, initiatives.
Those things could be, yes, hours associated with internships. They could be also training dollars for our teachers. They could also be potentially scholarship dollars for our students. And if perhaps we do have, if you will, a engineering focus in one of our buildings or a manufacturing focus in one of our buildings, perhaps they would also lend their expertise on some committee work as well.
Also on Monday, I spoke by phone with Brandt President Sean Semple from his office in Saskatchewan, Canada. Why did you choose this site and McLean County?
It's one of three sites that we were looking at in the agricultural areas there. One was in Iowa, one in Ohio, and this one in Bloomington. In Bloomington, obviously, this particular site has a very modern factory that's there that was available. It's right in the heart of the corn and soybean area, which is a focus for Brandt as we look to extend our reach into that area.
Why is now the right time for Brandt to expand with manufacturing in the U.S.?
To, I guess, show our support for the area. And, of course, making an investment into manufacturing and a little closer to the customers is always a good way to do that. We've enjoyed the business that we've done in that area. And, obviously, with a lot of the changes that are happening within the taxes and so on in the United States, this was a good reason to kind of make it happen now. And I guess we are looking forward to doing more and more business in that area. I mean, obviously, the agricultural land in this particular area is some of the richest land in the world. And we've wanted to look at what we could do to manufacture products for that market.
How many jobs are we talking about?
Well, for factories of this size that we operate today here in Canada employ around 500 people producing the products that we produce, okay? Now, I'm not here to say today that you're going to have 500 tomorrow, so I don't want to mislead anyone, but we've committed to kind of a ramp up of employees. We expect there to be, you know, within kind of the 6 to 7 years, about 300 employees. But it'll ramp up. We have a production schedule providing that we move ahead that will start sometime in the first quarter. So the employees will start, will retain some of the ones that are there today, so they're not laid off, but we'll also then move ahead with production schedule next year that will start with kind of a guaranteed base of at least 50, but then we'll ramp up to, like I said, 300 by year 6 and 7. But my hope is that we would be at a normal density, which we would have in a factory this size, of around 500, you know, within, call it the first 10-year window.
How much of a capital investment are you planning to make at the plant?
Yeah, all I can say on that, this won't be completely published, but it'll be in excess of $20 million initially through the acquisition of the plant and our initial improvements that we plan to make, both in equipment and some facilities as well. We're hoping to make this more than just a facility and more than just a plant, though. Again, we have no headquarters in the United States, and that we're hoping that Bloomington can serve more than just a factory for Brent. And that's one of our hopes as we move forward. So there may be other things that we will announce once we're moving ahead.
So why are property tax breaks necessary, in your view, to make this deal happen?
Well, when you're starting up a factory from a dead standstill, and especially when you're starting from a new into a new country, there's a lot of initial startup costs, and that this helps defer some of those costs when it relates to, you know, getting the people running, getting the jigs and fixtures moved in, retooling the factory. There's a lot of startup costs, and this really shows a commitment by the community to really want the facility there and want to see it work, and I guess we very much appreciate that, and it helps defer those costs.
If these taxing bodies approve the abatement, you're definitely coming then?
I believe that we have most of everything else in order that we would be in a position to move ahead. That would be one of the last things to check off, and we would hope to make an announcement in the next coming few days.
That's Sean Semple, president of Brent Industries. I'm Ryan Denham.
The McLean County Board is scheduled to vote today on the Brandt Agreement. Heartland Community College's board is next on November 21st. The EDC says not all seven taxing bodies would have to approve the tax breaks for Brandt to come here. The largest taxing bodies, Unit 5 and McLean County, are the key votes. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. During the more than 2 years that Illinois went without a state spending plan, hospitals, dentists, and other health care providers waited months or even years to get paid for services to state employees and Medicaid patients. The state is borrowing money to help pay down the amount due to health providers, but in this week's Illinois Issues in-depth report, Dean Olson examines the long-term damage done to the healthcare system in Illinois. Mary Hansen talked with Olson about the effect on those insured by the state.
One of the groups that's been most affected by the state budget impasse has been those with health insurance through the state of Illinois, such as state workers or university employees, and also Medicaid patients. And now that the state has a budget, have those challenges gone away for those patients? Is the healthcare system kind of back to normal?
The healthcare system really isn't back to normal. The impasse caused a big delay, even more of a delay, in the payments to people, hospitals, chiropractors, medical device dealers who serve state workers. And it's interesting because state workers have great health insurance, but during this impasse, they've really started to feel the pinch of what's going on in state government.
And how have they seen that pinch? How's it kind of affected the care that they can receive?
Well, their providers are often getting paid up to 2 years after performing services. So as a result, these providers, some of them have asked for upfront payments for the cost of care. Some dentists have done that. If they are not preferred provider dentists, they can ask for upfront payment for the entire amount, and then the patient can get reimbursed. Other things that patients have gone through is Springfield Clinic, the big multi-specialty group, used to wait for the state to pay its share before it would ask for collections from the workers, from the patients. And it changed that practice during the impasse and asked for those payments, those copays and deductibles up front. So these are ways that patients have been impacted.
Do you know if all of these providers are continuing to do that or if some have stopped? Is there any indication of, is the situation getting at least a little bit better now that we have a budget?
Well, we've heard anecdotal reports from AFSCME that these situations are continuing. We've had some positive signs from some providers like Washington University School of Medicine. Their doctors there, starting November 1st, all of them are accepting new patients from the state of Illinois. In the past year, some of those groups had stopped accepting new patients because of these big backlogs, and that created problems.
The bill backlog, it numbers now $15 to $16 billion. How much of that money is owed to these doctors or dentists or health insurance companies?
Over $9 billion of that money is owed to Medicaid providers and to providers that serve the state government workforce and the retiree workforce. So the good thing is that those bills are among the first that are going to be paid because the state gets a federal match for the Medicaid bills. So that improves the state's cash flow even more. And the bills that are owed to providers of state workers and retirees are among the latest bills. They're backlogged the most. And so they're generating these large percentage increases. I think it's between 9 and 12% a year in interest charges.
So the state still owes healthcare providers billions of dollars. And if you are passing along at least some of those costs to patients, what will it take to get the healthcare system back on track?
Until this cash flow situation improves, this situation is going to continue because there's going to be billions of more dollars that are owed. Everybody knows that this is not a good situation to be in, but the political fight so far has kind of overshadowed that. It's possible that if this backlog isn't resolved in the long term, that people will see a recurrence of many of these stringent collection practices and other bad things that are happening to patients.
Dean Olson is a reporter at the State Journal Register in Springfield, covering healthcare. You're listening to Sound Ideas. It's Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Bloomington Normal music scene has seen rejuvenation in the last 7 years. That's according to many musicians and fans, including a promoter in Champaign-Urbana. GLT's John Norton digs into how and why.
Michael Klug and Joe Borberly of Bloomington's Jacked Up and the Empty Bottles say they've seen both the drought and the resurgence of the Central Illinois music scene. Klug says it's about time.
The music scene was non-existent forever, it seemed like. Yeah. I mean, yeah, of course, there was always, you know, a couple of bands playing here, a couple of bands playing there, but there was never anybody at any shows ever.
Any idea what the catalyst might have been?
In my view, it's the castle.
I totally agree.
Many in town share that view of the decade-shuttered movie theater reconditioned to a live music venue, even those who view the scene through a wider age lens.
My name is Edwin Pierce. I've been a resident of Bloomington at Normal since 1977 when I came here for college from California.
40 years later, Pierce is an elder statesman on the Twin City music scene. Musically, he's probably best known as one of the two guitarists in the 80s, 90s Twin Cities rock band, the Something Brothers. That band toured the Midwest incessantly. This is one of their more popular songs from those days.
When five holes round out me in my truck, don't even stop at home. I'm gonna meet the Something Brothers at the Metropole. And it's 1, 2, 3 in the morning.
Pierce also owns the popular Monster Pond stores in Normal and Bloomington, and he's still active in the music scene as the guitarist of the 80s cover band, Retrofit.
The Castle Theater has been instrumental at bringing live music to the area. Good live music.
But he had a slightly different take on whether that translates to resurgence.
And that seems to bring people out, and therefore that makes you feel like the music scene is better.
It's not necessarily been revived, it's always been here. It's more visible now.
That's Chris Goldwitzer. He's a local musician and promoter of small shows. This is Planes Mistaken for Stars, a show he promoted at Firehouse Pizza in Normal in 2014.
It used to be if a small, popular band came, they would play maybe in a rec room at ISU. No place bigger than something the size of Six Strings. But now there's a big room available, so the size of band that can come is much bigger.
So among those paying attention to live music in town, one thing is unanimous. The Castle Theater has been a boon to seeing good national touring acts on a regular basis. But is the scene rejuvenated? The consensus seems to be yes, but there is nuance, as Pierce and Goldwitzer hint. That nuance tends to break down along age lines and the era resurgence is being compared with.
I'm trying to remember back in the 80s and the 90s, the scene was huge.
That's Jan Lancaster. She's owned the Bistro in downtown Bloomington for nearly 25 years.
We would always be out every night, and there would be live music even early in the week. Like now you can't find, you know, any bands, you know, usually Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that really starts concentrating on Thursday, Friday, Saturday. But at that point, you could go and hear live music almost every night of the week.
Oh, definitely agree with Jan.
Terry Lance is a Bloomington native. In the 80s, if there was live music in town, she was there and saw tons of bands, including Pork and the Havana Ducks.
Oh, I do this song. I love this song.
She remembers a happening live music scene.
There were definitely more places for live music in the 80s.
Than today?
Than today.
Like the volume of clubs and venues playing music was larger in the 80s.
I would definitely say the venues playing music was larger in the 80s. They may not have something every night, but you could find something every night.
Scotty's was one of those popular 80s haunts, as was Mosey's, the Pub, C2 East, McLean County Bar, Stan's, the Lazy J, the Metropole, among others. Jan Lancaster remembers when Robert Buford took over a side of his mother's restaurant called Susie's.
And that became kind of really known for the blues and jazz scene. Across the street, Daddy-O's wasn't there yet, but eventually we had Country Nights there, Killarney's at that time. Almost everyone along the street had some sort of live music going.
And the bands playing regularly at that time included the aforementioned Something Brothers and Pork and the Havana Ducks. There was also Mojo Stew, the Mechanics, Timothy P. and the Rural Route 3. There was Aztec Neighbors, Hanover Fist, Captain Rat and the Blind Rivets, and this band, Cool Ray and the Polaroids. To those who lived for live music in the Twin Cities in the 1980s, all agree Bloomington Normal was a vibrant music town.
My name is Morgan Schulte. I live in Bloomington. I'm a special ed teacher by day.
Nights and weekends, she promotes music through Gabriel Events.
I love music.
You're listening to the music of the Spelunkers, the Bloomington-based band that toured the Midwest beginning in the mid-1990s. That's about the same time Schulte immersed herself into the Twin Cities music scene.
We had Lizard's Lounge. Everybody went there. They'd pay a cover, $5 cover to get in. Then they'd hop over to Juju's and listen to live music there for $5. Then they'd go head over to Daddy-O's and pop $5 in the door and head in there. That's what everybody did, and every place was packed.
Besides Spelunkers, you could see Public Display of Funk, Hip Pocket, Full Size Jimmy, and the Seed Band, among many others. This is Bottle of Justice, formed in the late 90s on the ISU campus. Edward David Anderson landed at ISU in the mid-90s and jumped right into the music scene. Many consider he and Cody Decoff, a.k.a. Chicago Farmer, to be the heartbeat of the Bloomington Normal live music scene today. Anderson remembers these bands well, and the scene in Normal at the time was vibrant.
There was tons of house parties and basements and the gallery and the stadium and Shanigans and Rockies, Spankies. They all had live music. All those places did. This is my
life now. Some of my fondest memories of live music. In the early days, there were the charter members who came up with the pub crawl.
That is Doug Lance. He and his wife, Terry Lance, owned and operated Rosie's Pub in downtown Bloomington from 1996 through 2001.
I can remember Gary from the Grand Cafe, Jan Lancaster.
My friend Gary Lundberg and I came up with this idea to start a pub crawl, which started then in, I believe, 1993.
One weekend, we had estimated 8,000 people came to downtown Bloomington to do what was then called the Jazz and Blues Pub Crawl.
We brought in jazz, blues people from all over the country.
I think that's when the pub crawl was at its absolute heydays. So the 90s, I remember fondly, Scotty's was going on.
Again, Morgan Schulte.
We had the house shows at the La Crosse House on ISU campus.
It was a vibrant music scene.
Live music was booming.
And then all of a sudden.
And then I don't know what happened.
About 2001 is when the music scene locally just fell off the map.
I guess I started seeing the change 96, 97, 98, where things were going more to the DJs, and it was all about the DJs.
Jan Lancaster has owned the Bistro in downtown Bloomington since 1993.
After Daddy-O's opened, I mean, he continued to do a live music scene, but as far as the other bars and the little bars, it got where they all just put in a DJ.
Musician and new club owner Chris Goldwitzer argues that despite that, live music at the time actually didn't fall off the map.
Okay, there's a couple ways you could look at it. It just went underground or got smaller.
quite literally meaning it's in houses and garages and basements.
Mandatory hardcore song topic. Christian.
This is Sutek Conspiracy at the Prairie House in Bloomington in 2001. The Prairie House and others, including what was called Pool Party House, The Kitchen, Das Fun House, and dozens of others, catered to a younger audience. They featured punk, garage, and alt-rock bands that couldn't land a gig in the clubs.
The gallery closed. That was one of the last bastions for bands that didn't do covers. Lizard's Lounge was down here, but then it became Pauly's that catered to underground music. There were a few other bars that did, but for the most part, you lost access to stages, per se.
There was another scourge working against live music at that time, one that didn't sit well at all with Doug and Terry Lance when they owned Rosie's Pub through the early 2000s. He said at that time, he had one unbreakable rule.
I will never, ever have karaoke. And I didn't. People would go on that karaoke trail. That's what we'd call it. It was not good for the music scene, and it, quite frankly, wasn't that good for the bars.
You're listening to a YouTube clip of a 2009 karaoke performance at Kegler's Pub in Bloomington. A young lady is covering Mr. Jones by the Counting Crows. It's a type of sound that's not a good memory for Terry Lance.
Not to be rude, but it was a bar's nightmare in a sense. You might get a lot of people in the door, but they're just drinking water and soda. They were only there for the karaoke performance.
By all accounts, the 20-aughts was a tough time for live music in Bloomington Normal. Edwin Pierce of the Something Brothers fame thinks the 2009 state smoking ban also had an impact.
But I really wasn't a karaoke guy, so I was missing the bands.
But you definitely saw that was happening, though.
Yeah, and I think that the downtown Bloomington kind of curtailed there a bit, because I don't want to bitch about the police. They're doing their job. But there was a lot of DUIs going on. I think people got scared of going downtown Bloomington.
So what brought the live music scene back from the death grip of DJs and karaoke? Here's Jen Lancaster.
I think that it was just time. And I think everybody got kind of sick of just that electronic DJ sound.
Hey, folks, this is Cody Dekoff, Chicago farmer, coming to you all the way from South Center Street in Bloomington, Illinois.
I arrived here kicking and screaming the day that I took the stage.
Yeah, I think the Castle has definitely reignited the fire here in the local music scene. It seemed like we had a little slow burn happening there, and the Castle kind of put the fuel on the fire and really blew it up.
Can you take how that has translated outside of the Castle Theater into getting people excited about the music scene as a whole in town?
You know, you have to have something to you to play the Castle. I think it demands quality. It inspires people to go home and write better songs and play better guitar and keep better rhythm. And it inspires people to, you know, make their music the best quality they can so they can go hit that same stage.
Rick Valentin and Rose Marshak have been privy to a number of scenes. They're half of the punk rock outfit Poster Children from Champaign-Urbana that recorded on major labels and toured the country extensively in the 90s. This is from their early 90s Daisy Chain Reaction album. Both are now arts technology professors at ISU. They say a vibrant music scene includes a mid-level club like the Castle,
but then also a smaller scene where it's like, oh yeah, they can play to 10 people or 50 people, the local band can open up.
And that may be missing right now.
Yeah, and so I think the Firehouse kind of had that for a while in this town. That's what I was really excited about. But when that went away, and now I think Chris Gallwitzer, is going to be opening up a club that's kind of on that scale.
The scheduled December debut of Gallwitzer's Night Shop Club in downtown Bloomington has bands and fans in the Twin Cities buzzing. On this day, he and business partner Matt Spears are working feverishly to finish a total remodel of the former Main Street Grill location in downtown. When completed, Gallwitzer says the venue will have a state-of-the-art sound system and the ability to accommodate 200 music fans.
The success of the Castle absolutely opens the door for us to open up this kind of place and try to bring in great talent that fits this room.
For example, it's not always economic for the Castle to book a show they know won't fill the room, like one of his favorite bands.
And they played at the Castle a few years ago, and it was incredible. Well, now I know Built to Spill will play here, so I'm going to try to get Built to Spill here. But another thing that enables us to open this up, all the places that I like in Champaign are closing. There's an ebb and flow, and right now it's absolutely Bloomington's time.
Rose Marshak says the scene has caught the attention of those outside the Twin Cities to the benefit of other businesses.
My friends in Champaign are starting to text me and say, hey, we're going to Bloomington to see a show. Where should we eat? I'll be like, oh, okay, what are these amazing restaurants in downtown Bloomington? Where should we tell them to eat? Also, you need to stop by the 8-Bit Game Arcade, too, and, you know, more places for them to go. Oh, I'm going to go see that show because there's this amazing restaurant and because there's this arcade that I need to stop at.
Chris Goldwitzer is hearing similar sentiments from the restaurants themselves. They're telling him they're anticipating his new club will bring more people downtown, and that will spill over onto their business. There's wide agreement that electricity has been crackling through the scene since the 2011 opening of the Castle Theater. But Michael Klug and Joe Borberly of Jacked Up and the Empty Bottles say part of that electricity has been generated by Cody Deacoff and Edward David Anderson.
I feel like Ed and Cody took this town kicking and screaming against their will and made a scene out of nothing.
Huh.
I feel like their personalities, like that they're such genuinely good people, made the scene.
There's a great group of people in this town that go to a lot of shows.
It's true. And it's because of those guys and their bands.
I knew I liked those guys. No, that's really humbling.
Cody Deacoff, what are they getting at?
I think maybe we just didn't give up on this scene because we really both do like Bloomington Normal. There's been some really talented people here that have left. You can't blame them for seeing what else is out there, but for reasons of life, you know, life happens. We're both still here. We really like this town.
Names in the lights, get out the van. Another night playing music with Edward David Anderson.
This is Deacoff, a Chicago farmer at a recent Castle Theater show where he shared the bill with Anderson, who says he now feels like a mentor.
Because I really remember vividly being the younger guy looking for guidance. And it's kind of fun to, you know, I've picked up a few things over the years to pass that along. Yeah, it feels good.
A collaborative spirit among musicians is something Rose Marshak and Rick Valentin have noticed since moving to Bloomington 7 years ago. But Marshak says it permeates the entire scene.
I was in Champaign yesterday talking about the incredible record stores we have here in Bloomington just to try to make everybody jealous. So there's Reverberation Vinyl, and then there's North Street Records, too. When I have Jared from Waiting Room come and talk in my classes, and I say, hey, Jared, isn't there another record store right next to Waiting Room? Isn't North Street there? And do you guys, like, fist fight or something? What happens? And he says,
I think all the shops in town, all of us have our own tastes, and I think we try to cater to as many people as we possibly can with our own tastes and the things that they might like. So I think none of us try to step on each other's toes, so I think it just makes us stronger.
Seth Fine has been keeping his eye on the Bloomington Normal scene from his longtime home in Champaign-Urbana.
I'm cheering for the Bloomington Normal scene.
Fine is the founder and producer of the Pygmalion Festival. He says the Twin Cities music scene has now surpassed his town, at least for right now. Fine believes the next step to truly becoming a vibrant music town is to produce nationally touring artists with household names outside central Illinois.
That's what defines a scene more than anything. The venues set the stage. The record shops and the, you know, late night parties, that's all like ancillary to the idea that there is a core of musicians singularly focused and they might work as baristas or whatever, but that is secondary to their primary role as musicians in a singular band.
I'm just a plain old Midwestern boy.
Hokey Lafarge is arguably the only native son or daughter with that national name recognition right now, but even he more closely aligns with St. Louis than his hometown of Normal. Despite that, Chris Goldwitzer says Bloomington Normal has other positive attributes when considering its musical vibrancy, such as proximity to major cities, including Chicago and St. Louis.
For the logistical benefit of having shorter drive times and expenses getting to the next stop, but also if they're playing a bigger market, people will still come from that market to see them 2 days in a row.
He says proximity to nearby similar-sized towns can also be factored in.
If a show happens at the Castle Theater in Bloomington, a third of the crowd will be from Springfield, Peoria, or Champaign.
Though comparing live music eras is about as subjective as comparing sports eras, all agree the scene in Bloomington Normal has bounced back from the musical depression of the 2000s, and that the Castle Theater is the game changer when comparing eras in the Twin Cities. Bloomington's Doug Lance speaks for many when he says he is once again excited about the live music scene in the Twin Cities.
I could compare it to when it was at a very high level in the late 80s when I came to town, and in the 90s, I can go almost anywhere and hear live music now. When I share that with my children.
For WGLT, I'm John Norton.
Daylight savings in my pocket. I'm going.
listening to 9 p.m. to 5 by Bloomington's Chicago Farmer from his Midwest Side Stories album. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Castle Theater owner Rory O'Connor talks about his club and the Bloomington Normal music scene tomorrow on Sound Ideas and at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast and the individual stories and interviews today from John Norton and Ryan Denham. Also, thanks to Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner for his time today. Let us know what you think of Sound Ideas on WGLT. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.